It's now 9:06.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. In the late 1990s, a new group of refugees started resettling in New Hampshire. Like the Bosnians and Cambodians before them, they were fleeing conflict and persecution in their home country. This group came from Rwanda, a small landlocked country in eastern Africa that had just suffered the largest single slaughter of a single group of people in the shortest span of time, the Rwandan genocide. Over the course of 100 days, more than 800,000, mostly ethnic Tutsis, were killed, with hundreds more fleeing and displaced. Dozens ultimately ended up in the Granite State, and many others were resettled around the U.S. Now today, 20 years later, as these refugees have slowly made new lives for themselves here, their counterparts back in Rwanda are still working through the process of rebuilding and reconciling themselves. Today in The Exchange, a look at Rwanda 2 decades after the genocide. Let's hear from you. Do you have ties to this country in any way? Do you think the international response to this genocide 20 years ago could have been different? And what have we learned from Rwanda? The Exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us a short email, the address exchange@nhpr.org. Post a comment on our Facebook page if you'd like. NHPR Exchange, all one word. We have 2 guests for the hour. Eric Cleven is with me in studio, assistant professor in the politics department at St. Anselm College. Eric's research includes ethnic violence and conflict transformation. He spent time in Rwanda and Burundi in the mid-2000s as part of a project working on post-conflict dialogue. And Eric Cleven, welcome back. Nice to see you.
Thank you.
Joining us from D.C. is Augustine Nabigimana. He's a refugee from Rwanda who came to New Hampshire in 2000. He was program manager at a refugee settlement agency in the state for many years, but recently moved to D.C., where he founded the company Multilingual Links, which works in New Hampshire and Baltimore. And Augustine, a big welcome back. Great to have you.
Great to be with you, Laura.
Well, and Augustine, just what's been going through your mind this month as so many people reflect on this grim 20-year anniversary? Just to let folks know, Augustine, you were a boy of 14 when this happened, escaped, you know, by the skin of your teeth, so to speak. What's happening? What's going through your mind and heart right now, Augustine?
Laura, this is only a month of remembrance for the victims of the genocide. But also, when I think about, you know, the last 20 years, I think that wonder has not necessarily made the progress that you would expect to be. For me, I was too young to understand what was happening, but through the years, I have come to understand that, genocide could have been taken as an opportunity for building a wonder that will never be like the one before, and that certainly has not happened. And I'm very concerned. You know, on the day after the shooting down of the president's plane, we woke up in the morning and that was the news in all media outlets, and it was very chilling. And again, I was too young to understand, but I realized that something was terribly wrong when my dad, who used to wake up at 5 and go to work, didn't go to work until 1 p.m. because he told us that the fact that the prison plane had been shot down meant that there might be he was expecting a potential regime change, and the previous regime changes in Rwanda came with ethnic violence, and so that really, really concerned him. Later in the day, my dad went out, and he came back with my stepmother, and my stepmother did not live with us, and it turned out that she was a Tutsi. I had never been told that she was a Tutsi at the time, and therefore she was a target. So she lived with us, and for the next 3 months, it was a month of terror with armed men coming to demand money or kill my stepmother. Now, luckily, she survived the entire ordeal. Suddenly, My dad was poor at the end of the entire ordeal because every time the men would come, we had to give them money so that they won't kill my stepmother. But her kids from other, you know, prior marriage were not so lucky to survive. Actually, I later learned that one of them was killed near by our house, which suggested that she might have been coming to seek shelter at our house, and that's very chilling. Also, many people on my mother's side lost family, including again a maternal uncle whose family was decimated, meaning completely gone. Kids, mother, father, and everybody. There's nobody left to tell any story or what might have happened. And I think, you know, the most, you know, Western media have and the current government regime have this narrative about the 100 day of genocide. But I'm really sorry to say that the genocide, from my perspective, goes beyond that, because in the aftermath of genocide, I went to the Congo as a refugee, and unfortunately, when the government you know, joined the rebel group that was trying to overthrow the Congolese government, They did destroy many refugee camps, and yes, thousands of refugees died in a process, and they were targeted. I mean, there's a UN mapping report that was published in 2010 that speaks to targeted killing of Hutu refugees, and I might be quoting here where the report says that some of those crimes against humanity might have constituted a genocide. And so, to me, genocide did not stop within 100 days, as some might believe or might have heard. And I'm concerned about the ongoing killings, and especially targeting of those who are in the who are critic of the current regime in Rwanda.
Well, yeah. So I'm hearing concerns about the future of Rwanda and the current state of Rwanda, but also lots of memories, you know, of your family's struggles, Augustine. And you're right. We're wrapping it up a little too neatly and easily by calling it 100 days of genocide. Just to remind people briefly, Augustine, and then I want to bring Eric into this as well. When you talked about the president's plane being shot down, this was kind of the spark, right, that lit this whole genocide. The president was killed after his plane was shot down. A judge blamed the Tutsis for this, and this started the whole Hutu attacks on Tutsis. That's sort of the Reader's Digest version, the easy version, right, Augustine? Do I have it right?
That's correct. So, you know, leading up to genocide, obviously there had been, you know, political tensions because, I mean, I think that the then President Habyarimana had negotiated a peace accord with the Tutsi rebels. And to my understanding, there were issues with implementing that accord. I mean, I'm not a politician. But again, at least an accord was in place, and while there were problems, there was a potential for it to work and integrate the leadership of the rebel group into the government at a time. So the shooting down of the plane not only you know, was devastating for many Rwandans, it also ended the Arusha Accord that had been kind of worked on by the international community as we know it, and it is never talked about. But
the people were working
that
so hard
was
on
the case. Yeah, definitely.
And Eric, just again reflecting on this 20 years, and Augustine's right. You know, it didn't wrap up neatly in 3 months. What do these sort of commemorations, 2 decades? You know, what do these mean for people who went through this? These markers.
Well, I think it's important that we're not forgetting about what happened. I think it's important for people to have the memory and the recognition of what happened, you know, to validate their experience of what they went through. That's an important part of it. That's part of my concern that I share with Augustine about where Rwanda's going, because I think that memory is being very tightly controlled in Rwanda itself. You know, we're focusing a lot on it in the West, and also looking at what the West's role was in the genocide. But people in Rwanda are not as free to be able to express what they went through and what they experienced than people who have questioned the regime's kind of packaging of the genocide have also been silenced. And I think that means that real reconciliation and real commemoration of it hasn't really had a chance to happen.
Now, give us a little more there for people who aren't quite familiar with how the president, Paul Kagame, has been approaching this 20-year marker.
Mm-hmm. Well, as Augustine said, there's been a lot of, you know, this, the genocide in 94 wasn't the first time there had been violence between Hutus and Tutsis. And I think the one way that Kagame tried to deal with this after the genocide was to try to just not talk about any ethnic divisions, not talk about Hutu-Tutsi divides.
We are all Rwandans.
We're all Rwandans. And, you know, anybody who tries to bring that up, even if you're coming from the outside, like I was, trying to help promote dialogue and people coming back, returning to their communities, you could be accused of divisionism. You could be accused of undermining, you know, this bright future. You know, and on the one hand, you could say, okay, we need to move on. We need to forget. But
yeah, maybe he's got a point. What do you think?
Well, you know, there is a point to that. But I think that in a way that you're just suppressing a lot of things that are connected to this very, very traumatic event and not allowing people the chance to move on. In Burundi, which has also had Hutu-Tutsi violence in connection with a long civil war, there's been a lot more openness around those divisions.
So go ahead, Augustine. Did you want to jump in there real quickly?
Yes, I just wanted to say, like, Rwanda has never had an ethnic issue. The issue is the politicians using ethnic as a playing card to kind of divide people and pit people against against one another. So where, you know, before 1994, you know, the regime was oppressing Tutsis who were a minority. Now you're oppressing the Hutu majority and somehow expect that, you know, nothing. I mean, again, I feel like, you know, the things are boiling up again is simply because, I mean, you can only oppress people for so long. You know, things that happened, the recent, what do you call it, the recent political unrest in, you know, in Libya and other Middle East countries, you know, didn't happen overnight. It was people frustrated by overtime of being oppressed and not allowed to express their feelings. The issue of not just remembering, you know, we have many Hutus who have been killed. And it's fantastic that we're remembering, commemorating the Tutsis who were killed in 1994 because it was devastating. But you're not working toward a peaceful country when you
don't recognize the losses of both. Yeah.
That's correct.
Augustine, hold on there. Lots more thoughts in just a moment. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio, 919. Good morning. Winter is hard on cars, especially in New Hampshire. If you're thinking about upgrading your car, truck, or motorhome this spring, why not donate your old one to NHPR? It's easy. We fill out the paperwork and arrange for pickup and sale of your vehicle. You can go online to nhpr.org for more details. More on Remembering Rwanda coming up on The Exchange, then a 10 on The Diane Rehm Show, the ongoing political battle for tax reform. New Hampshire weather, we have a flood watch in effect for all of New Hampshire through tomorrow evening. Cloudy rain today, could be heavy at times, windy. There's a possibility of some isolated thunderstorms in southern parts of the state, highs today in the 60s. Support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners, and Geriatric Psychiatry Services at Frisbee Memorial Hospital in Rochester, specializing in mental and behavioral health for people 65 and older in outpatient or inpatient settings, frisbeehospital.com. And New England College offering summer courses towards your bachelor's degree. Information at nec.edu. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. A look at Rwanda today in The Exchange, 2 decades after the genocide there. 1-800-892-6477 is our number. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Facebook is NHPR Exchange, all one word. 1-800-892-6477, again, is the number. If you have ties to this country in any way, we'd love to hear from you. Also, what do you remember about the international response to this 2 decades ago? Could it have been different? And more broadly, what have we learned from Rwanda? The number, 1-800-892-6477. With me in studio, Eric Cleven, assistant professor at St. Anselm College. His research includes ethnic violence and conflict transformation. He has spent some time in Rwanda on this. Also joining us from D.C. is Augustine Nabigimana. He's a refugee from Rwanda with deep ties to New Hampshire. He's working in D.C., New Hampshire, and Baltimore now. Again, you can join us, 1-800-892-6477. Joining us by phone from Massachusetts is Stephen Kinzer, author and journalist. He's covered more than 50 countries on 5 continents. His books include A Thousand Hills, Rwanda's Rebirth, and The Man Who Dreamed It in 2013. Stephen Kinzer, good to have you. Thanks for your time.
Good to be with you.
Well, let's talk about the man who this book is about, and that's Paul Kagame, the president of Rwanda. He's been a political figure in the country for a long time, president for some years now. Where does he come from, Stephen? What's Paul Kagame's political resume?
It's really a fascinating and I think pretty unique story. So in the early 1960s, as Rwanda was moving towards independence, there was a spasm of communal violence. The Tutsi minority was the victim of these pogroms. They fled by the thousands into nearby countries, many into Uganda. Paul Kagame was just a small child when his parents fled their homeland, Rwanda. And he grew up as a refugee in Uganda. He then became part of a generation that grew up realizing, if we, our generation, doesn't do something to get back to Rwanda, where the Tutsi were being forbidden to return, we will never go back. So he had to devise a strategy, along with a group of others, to organize some kind of what they called an armed return or an invasion. And that is what led to the civil war, ultimately culminating in the 1994 genocide.
So he takes credit, though, for ending the genocide, right, Stephen?
Absolutely. The story is that the Kagame group, this group of exiles or kids who had grown up in exile and become soldiers, invaded their homeland. They marched back into Rwanda in 1990. There was a period of fighting off and on that lasted until 1994. And then, just as a peace accord was about to be signed, the old regime, which was dedicated to racial and communal separation, launched the genocide. And it was then that Kagame's troops swooped down from their mountain and riverside redoubts and crushed the genocide regime. That was the period that of killing that ended in the spring of 1994.
Well, and jumping forward to today, and I want to bring our other guests in as well, Stephen. But so here we are 20 years later. He's president. He's been president for a number of years. The verdict seems to be mixed on Mr. Kagame. What's that about?
It's a fascinating situation, I think, when you look at Kagame, Rwanda, and their places in the world. I've worked in many parts of the world, and I've noticed one thing, that it's usual that the human rights community and the development community, people that are interested in getting poor countries to become prosperous, are usually on the same side when it comes to assessing one government or another. The human rights activists and the development workers are usually thinking a certain government is good, or they will agree a certain government is bad. Rwanda might be the one place where there's a huge difference of opinion between those two groups. Development experts think that Rwanda might be the most promising country in the world. The statistics for health care and other measures of national development are astonishing compared to anything that's happened in Africa in recent years. So there are some people in the development community who think Rwanda could be the model for how poor countries can stop being poor. But then the human rights people have a very different view. Many of them see this as a patina behind which repression is the central factor of life in Rwanda. There are indeed restrictions on what can be said and done politically in Rwanda. The government argues this is necessary to prevent another outburst of communal hatred and violence. Others say it's too excessive and it's intended to cement Kagame's rule. So in the human rights area, he's still very controversial, even though among development specialists, he's very popular.
Interesting. Kind of like China, Stephen, huh? You know, great on the economy, not so great on human rights?
Well, I think their idea would be to look at some country like like South Korea or Taiwan, or even Singapore, that emerged from strong one-man rule or centralized authoritarian rule, and then once it became economically prosperous, was able to open up politically. But Rwanda is a very special case because of what has happened there. The stakes of guessing wrong are very high. And that's another thing that makes the Rwanda example so interesting.
Well, I want to bring Augustine Nabagimana in with us. And Augustine, you expressed some of the same concerns at the beginning of the hour that Stephen is sharing with us now. What do you hear, Augustine, from folks back in Rwanda about Paul Kagame and this sort of dual assessment, you know, great on the economy, not so great on human rights, Augustine?
Yeah, so I have a few points to make here. Number one, I think that the Kagame regime is probably the most deadly regime in my assessment in the 21st century. Number one, looking at not only refugees who were killed, who were followed and killed in the Republic of Congo. Personally, I lost a brother and two sisters. I never been able to recover a body, so I cannot say for sure whether or not they are dead. But certainly, it's been again since 1996, so it's been years, and that's not a case just for Augustine. This is a case for millions of other Rwandans. Again, there are all assassinations going on. The killings, it's fair to say that Kagame is probably responsible for over 5 million people who have died in the Congo. So when you talk about development, you know, and here's what I would say to that, there's no development that can substitute human rights and freedom, okay? Rwandans are hardworking people, so it's not by surprise that Rwanda is moving with the world in terms of development. You know, what Rwanda needs is human rights and freedom of speech. You know, we have an American professor who went to Rwanda a few years ago to defend a Victoire Ingabire who had gone there from Europe to run against President Kagame, and she's now been accused of things, and she's now in jail. Peter Erlinda was also jailed. This is an American, okay? Accused of genocide denial simply because of the comments he was making in defense of his client. And the reason I point that particularly to this case is that to illustrate how dangerous is this regime. And Rwanda received millions of dollars every year from the U.S. government. And if this guy can dare, you know, have the guts to, you know, imprison an American law professor who was also a lawyer in Arusha, Tanzania, you know, and then, you know, what do you think a regular Rwandan goes through? Day-to-day basis. Recently, January 1st this year, a former intelligence chief of Rwanda himself was assassinated in South Africa.
Yes, I read about that. Yeah, and
right.
Paul Kagame is blamed for that. He denies it.
That's correct. And the month before that, he had an assassination attempt against a former army chief of Rwanda. Again, these are very highly protected people. And again, I'm bringing those cases just kind of help people think about if those people can be targeted,
and
you know,
let me
who
just,
wouldn't be?
Let me jump in and bring Eric Clevin into this as well. And then Stephen Kinzer, I have another question for you. Eric, can you shed some light on, you know, what Augustine calls this deadly regime and this conflict between the human rights community and the development community in the West and their feelings about Paul Kagame? And then Stephen, I have another question for you.
Well, I think both Augustine and Stephen are pointing out where the new divisions are in the new Rwanda. And the question is, will Rwanda go the path of South Korea and become a prosperous democratic state, or will it go the path of Russia and become more totalitarian with more government-run development in the hands of a small clique around someone like Putin? Will Kagame become the new Putin? I mean, I think what he's done is, you know, the development that has happened has benefited a small elite, basically those elites who were with him in Uganda, and the people who grew up in exile, those are the people benefiting. The people at home, the vast majority of them living off of subsistence agriculture, are not seeing those benefits. There's a small, small class of skilled workers in Rwanda, and I think most of the benefits are accruing to them. And so we're seeing a high, high degree of inequality, and that's creating I think, new resentments and also new divisions that are not necessarily ethnic, but they're class divisions that have to do with whether or not you belong to Kagame's elite. And he's controlling not just the democratic process and not just the political parties, but he's also controlling businesses and rewarding supporters with positions in businesses that are partly government-run. So where this goes is a good question. I mean, Rwanda is a country of contrasts, and yes, there are many successes we could point to, both in development with, you know, the oft-cited proportion of women in parliament, which is the highest in the world. So there are some good things to point to, but there are a lot of ground for concern about what the direction is going to be in the next 10 years. And I think, you know, some of those things could boil up again, and that could lead to renewed violence. I agreed with Augustine earlier that there isn't really an ethnic problem in Rwanda. That's a thing that's created by politicians, but that may be necessary, right? If new tensions develop, the ethnic problem could once again be used to try to hold on to power as it was before. And it's, you know, often people think it's ethnicity that's causing this kind of violence. I think it's often the other way around. Violence creates ethnicity. The genocide made the divisions between Hutus and Tutsis politically relevant and very obvious to everyone. Now that's been, you know, there's a lid put on that.
Tamped down.
But that could change depending on where these new developments take the country.
And that leads to a question for you, Stephen Kintzer, and then I'll let you go. So in several interviews on this, again, you know, 20-year marker, President Kagame himself has said, look, he's trying to keep this, you know, he's trying to keep this country together. He's trying to keep the ethnic tensions under control. We're all one Rwanda. That's his line. He also says, look, Western countries, you should not be so critical, given that you did nothing to stop the genocide. You know, I was the one that had to ride in and fix it. So what do you think about that, Stephen?
Well, when you look back at 1994, when the genocide happened, Rwanda, probably along with Somalia, were about the two most ruined countries in the world. That was when both of them were essentially devastated by war, famine, all sorts of trauma. And it was reasonable to expect that they would have terrible futures. And actually, Somalia has progressed more or less the way anyone would have predicted. It's full of upheaval. It's never really managed to recover a semblance of normal life. Health conditions are terrible. There's a huge unemployment. Rwanda, however, has not proceeded the way one would have expected. There was no reason to predict that Rwanda in 20 years would have anything like the levels of stability that it has. Now, this leads to a fascinating question about the amount of free speech and political liberty that can be allowed in this situation. And I think you can really make an argument for both cases. One would say the situation is too volatile. We have to wait at least a generation until the hatreds that were inculcated in people on communal bases calm down. And until then, we can't allow open discussion. The other side would say that's just an argument to perpetuate the power of a small elite. And in fact, tamping this down is only going to increase pressure that will ultimately produce some kind of explosion. So given the arguments you could make on both sides, this becomes a high-stakes question with very great significance for the future of Rwandan stability.
Well, Stephen Kintzer, a real pleasure talking to you. Thank you so much for making time out.
Okay, thank you.
Stephen Kintzer, author and journalist. He's covered more than 50 countries. His books include A Thousand Hills, Rwanda's Rebirth, and The Man Who Dreamed It. The number for you to join us, 1-800-892-6477. Join us with your own reflections on the Rwandan genocide 20 years ago. Seems hard to believe. Your thoughts, questions, comments are welcome at 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange at nhpr.org. Facebook is NHPR Exchange, all one word. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. And both of you, here's an email that came in from Emily in Candia. She says, I visited Rwanda in February. You would never know what horrors happened 20 years ago. You can feel the peace there. Emily says, I felt more at peace there than anywhere I've traveled before. The people are so loving. She goes on to talk about the way people focus on their relationships and not materialistic things. She says she felt safer walking in Rwanda than she does in Manchester. Rwanda and its people, Emily said, what tragedy came from to what they are today. It is an inspiration that changed me. Emily, thank you so much for that. Augustine, what do you think?
Yeah, so that's quite an interesting assessment. I wonder right now, again, it depends on actually on where you go. There's no the political opposition has been crushed. You are either in jail, you are dead. This includes media as well. If you look to reports by the Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International, as well as the Reporters Without Borders, that's a sort of an international, you know, press association. You know, they point to Rwanda is not independent media again because you speak up, you might be found dead. You know, the next day.
So you're saying Augustine, Emily got a really surface view, scratch below the surface. It's not that pretty.
That's one, but also people simply don't talk about anything against the regime. Again, you know, keep in mind that if this is a government that can target someone in South Africa or other countries, I mean, very recently, I think like maybe a year or two ago, the British government warned one of the citizens there that the Rwandan regime might be planning assassinations against them. So if someone who's abroad can be targeted, what do you think if you Rwanda under this regime's control? And so people are very afraid of talking about the issues in Rwanda, and so I'm not really surprised that's the case.
Emily, thank you for that email. Let's take a call. This is Dave in Henniker. Go ahead, Dave. You're on The Exchange. Welcome.
Hi. I just wanted to report that my daughter is a junior in college studying this semester in Rwanda, and she finds it a wonderful place to be. It's safe. She's in Kigali, the capital, of course, but she's traveled to several places around the country and finds development of all kinds happening very fast. And she did spend 2 weeks in Uganda just as a comparison, and she found that although there's not as much repressive control in Uganda, there's no development at all. And so she's challenged by the fact that it seems as though you have to have much stronger controls of personal liberties in order to get development, but it doesn't seem like that's the best way to do it. And so it is a challenge.
Yeah, that's what we're working through, Dave. I appreciate that call. And we will talk in just a moment some thoughts on the thoughts that you bring to the table, Dave. Thank you for calling. 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. More reflections on Rwanda 20 years after the genocide in just a moment. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio, 939. Good morning.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the ongoing battle for a simpler, more fair tax system, then best-selling novelist Akhil Sharma on blurring the line between fiction and memoir, all coming up on the Diane Rehm Show.
The Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 till noon on NHPR. Support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners, and support also comes to us from the law firm of Oren Reno, bringing sound judgment and a practical approach to New England's legal challenges for more than 65 years, online at or-reno.com. And the Melanson Company of Keene & Bowe, with comprehensive roofing solutions for 80 years, adding solar to turn roofs into energy-producing assets, melanson.com. Good morning, it's 9:40. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're looking back at Rwanda 2 decades after the Rwandan genocide. And let's hear from you, 1-800-892-6477. If you have ties to Rwanda in any way, as some of our listeners have, join us. Also, if you remember back to the international response that was widely criticized after the fact, do you think that response could have been different 2 decades ago? And what have we learned from Rwanda? What do you think? Give us a call. The Exchange number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Facebook is NHPR Exchange, all one word. And Eric Clevin, just before the break, real interesting call from Dave. His daughter is studying in Rwanda. She's been impressed by the development in the country. We've heard that from others too this hour. And then she spent 2 weeks in Uganda, where he said she was less impressed. Things seemed to be more difficult there for people. So we keep getting back to this, don't we? Paul Kagame kind of being a very autocratic ruler. On the other hand, you know, things seem to be going well in other areas in Rwanda. I'd love your thoughts on that point that keeps coming up.
Right. Well, I think both of the, you know, Dave who called in and the email you got, you know, saying that people in Rwanda are wonderful people, it's peaceful, there's stability and order, I think that's accurate. And my experience in Rwanda was also very positive. I felt that everyone I met was, you know, they were wonderful, they were welcoming, very generous and hospitable. And so I think that's an accurate impression. I think you'd find that in Uganda and Kenya, too. I have found that in other East African countries, too. But, you know, the reality, as Augustine pointed out, is that this isn't really, it's coming at a cost. So, yes, there have been a lot of positive things that you can see. The developments have been less positive on the political side than on the economic side. You know, I think what you need development, you need economic investment, but you also need accountability of politicians. And the accountability side is what's generally lacking. In Uganda, in Kenya, in other countries, that accountability is not there. And therefore, you know, you don't get the development happening there to the extent that you see in Rwanda. In Rwanda, to Kagame's credit, he has actually done projects that have benefited people, but again, at a cost which really sheds some doubt on where the future of Rwanda is going to be. You know, because right now things could move in a direction where things could open up more, where that development could become accessible to more people, or it could move in a direction where a small elite will control this and the vast majority of the population will live in poverty. And yes, there'll be wonderful, you know, cheerful, great people to talk to, but they won't be developing as much as those who really benefit from this. So I think it's a very mixed picture. You know, and I would say I've traveled a lot in very many different countries. Probably the place where I felt the most safe was the Soviet Union when I visited that in 1983. There was absolutely no crime. Would I want to live
you
in
didn't
the Soviet
dare.
Union?
Yeah.
No.
So. Right. So safety, but yeah. At what cost? And, you know, to you, Augustine, then back to our listeners, Eric talks about accountability. I wonder what you think, Augustine. What is the West's role in holding the current Rwandan regime, President Kagame especially, accountable for what has happened since the genocide? You yourself, you know, a couple minutes ago, blamed Kagame for the death of your brother and two sisters, and I'm devastated to hear about that. So what is the West's role in this accountability question?
Yes, thank you. That's a very fantastic question, Laura. Listen, there are a couple of things. The Rwandan government says there's no longer ethnicity in Rwanda. Everything is okay. No problem. Okay. So no, the problem is here is that they use ethnicity when it's convenient. For instance, they recently redefined the 1994 genocide that the genocide against Tutsis, and you know, and that's fine. But again, if ethnicity does not exist, then where does the word Tutsi coming from? And then they use the word genocide technically to silence critics, and that includes the human rights organizations and media as well. And so in Western countries, including the United States, you know, usually we're able to hold public officials and elected officials accountable through, I mean, investigative media and reporting. And this is something you can't get out of Rwanda because, again, there's no media including international media, that is going to be investigating, you know, the Rwandan government. Kagame simply says no, and he's not going to allow that. What is very interesting that the moment you try to critique the Rwandan government, you know, if you are Rwandan, again, you are either killed or you are jailed. If you are Western and you are not jailed, they will try to tarnish, you know, they will turn to your image. If you look at, you know, some of the Rwandan responses to human rights reports or Amnesty International reports, it's always been, that again trying to tarnish their image, saying that they have other motives other than simply reporting on human rights abuses, and that again there is a sort of this consistency in how the Rwandan regime has been handling these kind of situations. I think that the Obama administration and other Western governments are finally coming to an understanding that this regime is not as rosy as they have thought. I think the world in Western countries have been guilted, to feel like, okay, we didn't respond, so we're going to have to maintain this guy who's strong and who can, put everyone in their place. But again, I argue that the opposite to oppression is what's going to lead Rwanda to a 21st, developed country that we all seek it to be. I dismiss the idea that you have to have strong and repressive regime in order to force
to thrive
development
economically.
To thrive economically. I mean, the two are not mutually exclusive, and I think I would even argue that the two complement each other. I mean, right now we have again millions of Rwandans abroad, many of whom who can not even go to visit Rwanda, never mind going to invest in Rwanda. If there was open, that Rwanda was an open society and people could speak freely and people were not afraid of speaking up, I'll go to invest. I'll be the first to go to invest in Rwanda if it was an
sure.
Open,
you've got a successful business here, and love to expand it to Rwanda. Augustine, just hold on a sec. We've got another caller who wants to join us. Mornay is with us from Lowell, Mass. Hi, Mornay. Go ahead.
Yeah, my own contribution is in Africa, especially. Any country, if you are an authoritarian leader, you will succeed because most of the politicians and the people, only authoritarian rule will make them be in order, in line with what the president wants. Because for you to know this, there will be no way this type of rule we have in the United States or any other part of the country in the West, so that democracy, freedom of speech, accountability of politicians ever be in Africa. So only authoritarian rule might able to work for leaders in Africa. That's why you see almost every African leaders are pushing towards authoritarian rule.
So Mornay, are you saying Africans can't handle democracy? That they don't want it? Or what are you saying there?
We do want democracy. But the problem is we abuse it when they try to give us. For example, they say they give you freedom of speech. They think freedom of speech is freedom of saying anything, whether it will cause violence, whether it will cause problem. We abuse those things. So that is the problem we have. And for our when democracy comes, most of our politicians are not accountable, very corrupt. And the people are suffering, and only authoritarian leaders who don't care what the West says or what anybody says will just go about and do what they think is good for the people.
Mornay, well, thank you very much for calling in. What do you think about this, Eric? And Augustine, obviously want to go to you too. Sometimes people say this about the Middle East too. I am not saying this, but people have said this too with the Arab Spring and so forth. Well, they don't really want democracy. They want authoritarian leaders. What do you think about this?
That doesn't really resonate with what I've experienced in Africa. I think my experience of talking to lots and lots of young people, in especially in East Africa, they are very much aware of the corruptness of the governments there. They're aware of the fact that politicians make promises that they then don't follow up on, and they want it to change. They want to be able to participate in democratic processes. But there's also a very, very large poor population, a population that's largely unemployed or struggling to survive. And so politicians have no problem recruiting young people to commit violence when they need to do that. It's easy to buy people to join gangs, to fight sometimes long ethnic lines. They also, you know, a lot of authoritarian leaders have the help of the West to do what they do. They get aid, huge amounts of aid that allows them to keep a small group of people, supporters around them, who they give lots of benefits to, and thereby hold on to their power. So I don't think that – I think there's definitely a democratic impulse in African countries. But the problem is poverty. Sometimes the problem has to do with the level of education of people to be able to organize, not so much because they don't understand what's happening. They're very aware of what's happening. But to organize collectively to resist that kind of oppression, that takes resources. And that's the kind of things that we take for granted. But that if you're living just to survive in Africa, you don't have time to go to political meetings or to organize associations that would be able to hold leaders accountable.
Sure, if you're barely scraping by, it's hard to have the physical and emotional fortitude to work on these things. Augustine, what do you think about our caller? Mornay, thank you for joining us.
Yes, so it's quite I think Mona's premise that you have to have an authoritarian regime in order, for a country in Africa to survive, it's a little troubling. Again, my experience is that you know, you can hold people accountable without being repressive, and you do so by having a very strong constitution that every and a good justice system, you know, where you know people where there are clear guidelines as to, you know, what public officials are supposed to do and what is they're not supposed to do, and so it's not through dictatorship and authoritarian regimes that Africa will come out of poverty. But again, and then keeping in mind that governments don't create wealth, people do create wealth. Government can facilitate economic development, but government itself is not cannot develop an economy. Again, it's kind of like putting sort of creating an environment in which the economic growth can happen, and so if someone shares the same belief that again people are the ones who create wealth and kind of forge economic growth, then how can that happen when again how can we attract investors, okay, in countries where they don't seem to be they don't seem to be a pathway to stability. I mean, I wonder again, it's 20 years later, it's a long time for us to be still talking about genocide and the killings and the probable conflicts, future conflicts in Rwanda. I mean, I think again, the regime has missed an opportunity to bring Rwanda to a level of democracy that Rwandans would expect. I mean, that I certainly expect, and I know many Rwandans expect we would have by now. Again, and this is 2014. This is not 1962 or pre independence.
Augusta, I have a quick question for you, and then one last question for both of you. Have you been back to Rwanda, Augustine, since this happened?
I have not been to Rwanda. I feel very uncomfortable with the thought of, again, keeping in mind that an American lawyer was jailed when he went to Rwanda. I could choose to be silent. I think that would be a disservice to so many people who cannot speak up for themselves when they're in Rwanda. And, you know, just lay a law, just like other people who are in Rwanda, and that will allow me to go to Rwanda because that's what the current government likes. But again, doing so from my perspective would be a disservice to so many who cannot speak because they are restricted as to what they can say, can't say.
Well, and here's the last question for you, Eric. We've sort of danced around the Western response 20 years ago. We've talked about accountability today and what the West's responsibility is toward the Kagame regime in terms of, you know, staying on it for the human rights violations and so forth. But let's go back 20 years just for a minute, Eric. Some people say this is a big stain on Bill Clinton's presidency, that he didn't do anything to stop the Rwandan genocide. Is that a fair assessment or not? What do you think?
Sure. I mean, I think the U.S. could have done a lot more. I think there were very easy fixes that could have prevented a lot of the violence. I mean, the peacekeeping troops that were in Rwanda at the time that the genocide started, there were peacekeeping troops there, definitely knew about that something was brewing. They knew about caches of weapons that were there. They weren't allowed to act. In some ways, I would fault the U.N. peacekeeping office in New York before I would fault the U.S. government, but both of them could have done things to avert the scale of the disaster, or maybe the whole disaster. If they had been given the mandate to, you know, step in and actually intervene, the peacekeeping troops. And I think since that, we've seen that that's changed. There's now a developing norm to protect people who are potential victims of things like this. And peacekeeping troops in Congo have since been given a mandate to actually fight rebel groups, you know, to actively engage them and not just to be stationed there, you know, to try somehow to be a presence, but to actually militarily engage them. And they have defeated, you know, rebel groups in Congo as a result of that. And that all comes out of, you know, the learnings from Rwanda. And I think, you know, Bill Clinton also acknowledged the failures in Rwanda when he started bombing in Bosnia and in Kosovo, where he then tried to do something.
So we've learned that UN troops being, quote unquote, a presence sometimes isn't enough.
It depends. I mean, it's not enough to it could have been enough if they'd had the right mandate to do what they were going to do. And I think peacekeeping troops very often do keep violence from starting up again. But in this case, it was a failure.
All right. Well, tough topic. And both of you, thank you very much for being with us. Augustine, it was wonderful to talk to you again. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Laura.
That's Augustine Nabigamana. He's a refugee from Rwanda, settled in New Hampshire in 2000. He recently moved to D.C., founded the company Multilingual Links, which works in New Hampshire and in Baltimore. Eric Clevin, it was good to see you too. Thank you.
Good to see you. Thank you for having me.
Eric Clevin, assistant professor in the Public Affairs Department at St. Anselm College. His research includes ethnic violence and conflict transformation. He spent some time working on that issue in Rwanda and Burundi in the mid-2000s. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. Our engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producers are Ellen Grimm and Faith Meixel. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our intern is James Pouliot. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The executive producer is Keith Shields, and I'm Laura Kanoi.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org.
I'm Laura Kanoi, and tomorrow on The Exchange, the ongoing conversation about school security. A recent stabbing incident injuring more than 20 students at a Pennsylvania school has again reminded us that violence can occur in any district and in any form. And schools in New Hampshire are taking note, continually adjusting their safety plans. We'll find out how this discussion is evolving. Send us your thoughts by email or Facebook, and join us for The Exchange tomorrow morning live at 9 and again at 8 p.m. on NHPR.
The IMM Show next at 10 o'clock on New Hampshire Public Radio, where support comes from you, our listeners, and from the New Hampshire Division of Economic Development, helping Granite State businesses grow and prosper, online at nheconomy.com. And Markham Amarge of Keene, New Hampshire, worldwide coating supplier, making their mark through people and innovation, locally and globally, for over 100 years.
These are the stations of New Hampshire Public Radio.
WEVO, Concord, 89.1.
WEVS, Nashua, 88.3.
WEVH, Hanover, 91.3.
WEVN, Keene,
90.7.
WEVC Gorham, 107.1.
WEVJ Jackson, 99.5.
WEVF Colebrook, 90.3.
And WEVQ Littleton, 91.9.
And online at nhpr.org.
From WAMU and NPR in Washington, I'm Diane Rehm. Many Americans will be scrambling today to get their 2013 tax return to the IRS. A few can anticipate a refund, but many wealthier Americans are paying more in taxes. The top 1% of earners pay 29.3%.